Blog Talk Radio.
Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're live because we're staying alive in this most existential moment with the intent to be configured. The Torah Chaim is talking to life, Torah Chesed, talking to kindness, Torah Rachim, talking to mercies. We now turn into Blog Talk Radio, and we humbly assert with a higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio, of course, of Soul Class. It happens to be Soul Class number 759, Medication Part 1. Blessed is our eternal creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha. Blessing upon the entire human family experience. With creator's help, our next broadcast is taking place right now, December 12, 2021. Now 11:31 Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island, equals AKA equals USA equals Uniting Souls Effectively / Effectively. Topic for discussion will be learning about what is meditation from a Torah biblical perspective until we reunite, which we've reunited now. And into this very moment going forward, may the Almighty, Merciful Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones. The tags for today's program are Eternal Creator, Divine Image, Redemption Now, Children of Israel working with the children of Noah to eliminate hatred, jealousy, and competition that's not needed upon the face of this blessed earth, Oral Torah Traditions, Written Torah Traditions, and the World of Science, which is not a contradiction to Torah, and Torah is not a contradiction to science. So we're listening now to a Niglin that's attributed to the times of the Baal Shem Tov, the patriarch of the modern Hasidic movement. Many people are not aware of the fact there's always been a Hasidic movement, but it morphed into different forms. So we're going to just turn down the music and bring in our host right about now for Really Big Shoes. Okay, joining us today is, in fact, our longtime co-host. And we've been separated a while because of the pandemic and also other work responsibilities that yours truly had to assume as part of just trying to survive from paycheck to paycheck. Dennis Ryan, our Rambam student teacher and disseminator of the teachings of the Nesher Gadol, the great eagle, of Moshe, Moses Ben Maimon. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Boker Tov. Baruch Hashem.
It's been, well, I don't even know when. I'd have to go back into the archives to see, Dennis, when we last programmed together. And what happened was, what brought about this program is earlier last week, I met a mutual friend of ours, Rabbi Daniel Mapur, formerly the spiritual leader of the Beit Mazel, the House of Fortune here in Crown Heights. And he asked me what was going on with the radio program, because he was aware of it for many years. And I said, well, I stopped basically because of my work obligations. And he suggested to me, well, you know, you started something good. I said, well, yes, my mentors have told me that. And he said, there's an axiomatic teaching about doing something good or starting something good is you don't stop. So then he suggested to me one person, and I should seek out other people to take over Soul Class. And I thought about it. It sounded like a great idea. But the next day, Dennis, I thought to myself, wait a minute. I put all this hard work into whatever we consider to be a long string of humble endeavors. And I figured, let's just keep on doing it. And I spoke it out with one of the individuals who work under me. And so we're going to be able to hopefully do future programs, whereas that person will be on coverage for me. I'm usually 24/7 coverage with the nature of my work, which that's all I'll say. And so this person will be able to cover for a couple of hours every Sunday morning. And therefore, we can do the program without the problem, without the reality of sometimes getting an emergency phone call. So, Dennis, it's great to have you back on.
If I can help in any way, I'm available, Don.
And you're being available as a help in every way. I'd like to start off, Dennis, and if you blessed souls listening out there, and by the way, if anyone would like to muster up the gumption, you should not make a presumption. This is just a conversation between Dennis and I. It's for those of you listening live or those of you hear the archive version. But right now, you do have the opportunity to call in if you want to participate, because usually we like to try to make our presentations as organic as possible. The call in number is 563-999-3688. That's 563-999-3688. But before we go forward into the program, a little preparatory comment, actually a prayer taken from a book called The Gathering in of Prayers by Rabbi Nachman, which was recorded by his number one student, Rabbi Nassen, and it goes something like this. As a practical outcome, may I merit with your abundant mercies that there should be no power to my evil inclination and the power of folly to confuse my mind and to nullify me, heaven forbid, from your true service by way of your precepts. And the evil inclination can dress himself up in precepts as if he's going to trick me with some sort of precept, meaning do this precept, which you should be doing, as opposed to doing something else. And what happened was is that the evil inclination can bury within this a net for the human being's feet, heaven forbid. And by way of these type of precepts that he's going to dress up in, that you know, alone Almighty Creator know this. Please, Creator, have mercy upon my soul, which has been orphaned, and save me from him, from his advice, meaning the advice of the evil inclination known as the Yetzer Hara. His advices are evil, and not to give the evil inclination that resides within each one of our hearts the power to fool us, heaven forbid, and to confuse us. Now, you might say, how can it be that the evil inclination would dress itself up in a precept to a person? So you say, an example of this is that, say, someone has a chance to help someone, and there's no one else to help that person around, but they'll say, I'd rather extend myself in my prayers, even in my learning of Torah, but here's a situation where you could actually save literally someone's life, which is likened to what is known as a chassid shota, a foolish, pious person who would see a woman drowning in the water and say, I'm not allowed to touch her. But by touching her and saving her life, you're actually promoting the idea what the Torah stands for, Torah's Chaim. So Dennis, any take on this, how sometimes we can get fooled in thinking what we're doing is the right thing when actually there's a higher good that is accessible to us to fulfill?
Yes, what happens is we are always in the presence of God, but we're also in the presence of the dark side. And we have a free will. And you must make choices in your life. You can't get away from choices. They are there, and you must recognize them. And that's why we have this program, is to help you make choices as to which side you want to be on, but how you can guard yourself and increase your ability to make better choices. So thank you for listening, and me and Don will do our best to help you wherever you need the help.
Amen. So, Dennis, I'd like to start off with, as I mentioned before, you quoted the you were paraphrasing and boiling down, breaking down teachings of Rambam from the philosophical realm of Rambam. I'd like to give two quick presentations of the more lawful side and the more precept side of Rambam, where he mentions that it is a mitzvah to love and fear our glorious and awesome Creator. As it says in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, and you shall love God your Lord. And also in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 13, fear God your Lord. Now, there has to be a practical path, because the Torah doesn't give precepts from the written oral Torah tradition without explaining how they should be done. So the Rambam goes on, and this is, by the way, in the second chapter of the Laws of the Foundation of the Torah, which are accessible in English as well as Hebrew and whatever language has been translated into. So the Rambam writes, what is the path to attain love and fear of him, meaning Creator? When a person contemplates his wondrous and great deeds and creations and appreciates his infinite wisdom that surpasses all forms of wisdom, a human being should immediately love, praise, and glorify the Creator, yearning with a tremendous desire to know God's great name, as King David wrote in Psalms 42, verse 3,
My soul thirsts for the Lord, for the living God. When a human being continues to reflect on these matters, he or she will immediately recoil in awe and fear, appreciating how he is a tiny, lowly, and dark creature standing with his flimsy, limited wisdom before he was of perfect knowledge, as David stated, "When I see your heavens, the work of your fingers, I wonder what is man that you should call him," in Psalms chapter 8, verses 4 and 5. So I want to make a caveat, blessed souls out there, that the Rambam, when telling us that we should feel like we're small and insignificant and lowly and a dark creature, that's not to give us a low self-esteem. But if you've ever been in a situation where, I don't know, I've stood before the Niagara Falls, I've stood at the Western Wall, I've stood at the areas of the cave where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Adam and Eve are buried, and the wives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are, you feel a smallness. And I've also stood before the burial site of Rambam in Tiberia. You feel a certain smallness. You realize there's an aura, there's a feeling, there's a spirit that's way beyond yourself. And so, therefore, eating a little humble pie is actually acknowledging that we have been gifted with this awareness to know that there's something greater than us. If the buck stops with us, we're in big trouble. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Well, to begin with, I'll paraphrase your words. Thou shalt love God. Well, you must do it on a voluntary basis. It is written that you should, but can you volunteer that? Is that part of your psyche? Can you understand how and when and if you can love God on a voluntary basis? You cannot be commanded to love God. You must accept it, and it becomes part of you once you accept it. So you must be able to control and manage your free will.
Okay, well, I just want to mention again that Rambam, let me just get back to there. Excuse me. Here we go. So Rambam again,
let me say it another way, Don. The Rambam asks you a question, but he never actually asks the question, and that is, who are you? So he gives you a whole bunch of things to read to understand, so you can voluntarily accept what you should be, how you should think, and how you can make good choices. And part of those choices is words that are written down by a holy man for many, many millennium. And the question is, if you understand them, can you accept them? In effect, can you love God regardless of time? In other words, Don started to say, we are nothing but a grain of sand in all the beaches of the world. Are we humble? Yes, but we're part of that sand. And that sand accepts the tide of the oceans back and forth, but we remain a grain of sand. You must be able to recognize what is the difference between you and the grain of sand.
True. I want to go back on what I mentioned before, because as I look at the Hebrew, what Rambam says, it is a mitzvah, which means a commandment. So I inferred we are commanded, which we are. The nation of Israel was commanded on these things. But the truth of the matter is, meaning I have the option of dialing up into the world of loving the Almighty. I have a mitzvah. I have an option or free choice, or to volunteer myself or to dedicate myself to fearing this Creator, which fear is something that is one of the most feared concepts in human existence, and sometimes it's the most misunderstood. But the point is that, yes, we were commanded in Deuteronomy, by the nation of Israel, but, of course, a person has to want to make that choice. Now, I just want to mention that mitzvah in the holy tongue in Aramaic means safta uchibor, meaning to connection. So when the way we of Israel look at our mitzvahs, and especially this commandment on how, or the path on how to love and fear Creator, Rambam explains it, that a person must meditate, which is basically the gist of today's program, to broaden out people's understanding. Now, meditation, I think, is one of the most positive, peaceful, passive, and paradoxically active experiences a person can experience, to be a little bit redundant there, in this world, Dennis, and that there are different levels. On the Torah level, again, the immediate outcome is to try to generate a greater love and fear of Creator to realize where one's place is. But if one is going to, so to speak, downsize oneself in the greater scheme of things, still the fact that, and this is something I saw by the Rebbe too, you should tell another human being they have a divine image, because that should awaken within them, like, if I'm made in the image of the Creator, first of all, I'm something of a downsizing of Creator, but in the human form, but there's something divine in that downsizing of that image of who I, what is being transmitted through to me through my human conscious awareness. That's your take on these ideas that we can go the breadth of the whole meditative experience, but ultimately it's to not only just help us get closer to Creator, but they get closer to themselves. And there's no contradiction between getting closer to Hashem and getting closer to oneself, because within yourself you're going to see there is the Almighty waiting for you to discover Him within yourself.
We do not love God out of fear. Why? Because God can create fear any time, but He doesn't want to do that, because He gave us a free will and you can make a choice. And He'd rather hear that you voluntarily have thought about Him long enough and said, that is the way for me. You need a way to follow. That way you can stay on a straight path and be in God's good graces, but not only that, learn to love Him.
Right. Thank you, Dennis. Now, before we get into some more biblical and Hasidic perspectives of the meditative process, I'd like to talk about the idea of mindfulness, because meditation involves mindfulness, and what used to be promoted as conjecture now is being shown in clinical studies of the efficacy of learning to become more aware of oneself. And some of the things that one can become more aware of oneself are the body sensations, the act of breathing, or sensory, feeling one's pulse, emotions, what you feel when you touch something, what you feel when you hear a sound of a song that you love, what do you feel when you smell a delightful aroma from flowers or you're walking through an apple field, and also to allow oneself to have emotions, but not to allow those emotions to go haywire, and to allow them to always maintain some sort of connection with some sort of intellectual processing. And I'm not talking about something profound, but rather just an intellectual processing based on practical experiences. There's also the idea of being mindfulness that we, for people who have are addicted to substances, that every moment that a person is not reaching for that addictive substance, one can start to become more in tune to how the body feels as the craving for that substance enters their mindset and can make even rattle them. And one can replace the wish for the craving to go away with the knowledge that will subside as you continue focus on the sensations, the emotions, and thoughts brought about from a craving. And then the next step is, what do you want to be mindful of? Do you want to do it through art therapy, which is for adults? It's just as it's powerful, I say, for young children. I've seen it in my work. Meditation, which is the theme of today's program, the main theme, as a form of medication. There's also, say, like Tai Chi. There's also yoga. And there's other forms as well. Acts of kindness can also be an act of mindfulness, meaning at the point that I'm helping someone else, I'm excluding any anxiety that I might have been experiencing the moment before, but saying, this as well shall pass, and I can use that time while it's passing to help another human being. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Well, it all comes down to the Rambam's teaching of Do you think about things? Do you examine them? Do you think the pros and the cons? Do you make an educated guess? Are you smart enough to do that? Can you control yourself to the point that you can analyze and figure out what is the best thing for you? So the Rambam says you must think. You can't be impulsive. If you're impulsive, are you looking for trouble? How many people do things that they don't think about? Well, you don't jump off a cliff without thinking about there's a long way down and you're not going to feel too good when you get to the bottom of the cliff. So human thinking relies on thinking alone because that's our impulsive. Our pulses are set to realize what we are physically doing and thinking about. So you must be able to control your impulses or emotions to the point that you think you're doing the right thing. You must have that confidence to say, I've thought about this, I know what the pros and cons are, and I'm willing to use my free will the best way I can.
Beautiful, Dennis. I want to spin off into one other area, which we've talked about briefly, if not with you, Dennis, but with other individuals who co-hosted Soul Talk's series, which started in around August of 2010, is the idea of brain plasticity. Now, this is not something which is philosophy. This is actually now clinically proven out that we used to think that the amount of neurons that you have in your brain or whatever cerebral activity you develop from, say, the beginning of life up until a certain age, and therefore everything starts to recede and sort of like stiffen up or weaken. But brain plasticity has shown us now that the brain has the ability to reorganize neural pathways, which are like the nerves, they're called neurons in the brain, throughout a lifespan, as a result of experience, which means that a brain has the ability to change with learning. And what's been clinically shown is that there's a change in the internal structure of the neurons, the nerves, notably the synapses, where the connection between one neuron and another, if I'm remembering correctly, that what happens is that how we can understand how the brain plasticity works or neuroplasticity works, that there can be a shutting down of a synaptic connection, because when say a person is contoured towards a type of addiction or a certain tendency towards depression, so new waves of thought coupled with other people doing kindness to the person and a person learning that part of the recovery of any type of addiction or say condition, say as depression, is that they have to try and help other people. And when we redirect how the synoptic connections are being redirected, okay, that in that process of redirecting them, that this will enhance the ability to learn and remember, and learning new skills requires lots of neurons. So you're actually, by learning a new skill or getting a new knowledge, you are redirecting the connections between nerve to nerve or neuron to neuron in your brain. Now, if that is not the miracle of the brain, that it is not a static piece of gray matter, Dennis, that it is a fertile soil waiting to be seeded with the fruits, which will eventually become the eventual fruits of greater love of Creator, greater fear of Creator, and just as important, not to be diminished one iota of accomplishment, to fellowship with other human beings, to encourage them to explore this wonder of the brain and how we can actually be self-imbibing in our own healing process. And that's why I connect meditation to medication. Your take on these matters, Dennis?
Yes, I remember years ago a lot of people used to say, follow your nose. I thought that was great, but I didn't know what the power of the nose was. But they kept saying, follow your nose. In other words, some people have a hard time making choices or decisions, so their advice to them was, follow your nose. Well, the real thing is your brain. Your brain has the capacity to handle any problem. You are not left out in the desert or the forest all alone. Mm-hmm. You're with your brain. You follow your brain. It works. However, we have found out through the years that we don't use much of our brain. Who is it? The smartest man in the world was Einstein. And when he died, they examined his brain to find out how much or what was the capacity that he used. He only used 7% of his brain. We have a huge capacity in our mind. If we're not using it, we are depriving ourselves of the one of the most important organs in your body. Yes, your heart beats to keep your body going, but your sanity depends on your brain. And if you're not using it, what are you substituting it with? Something that may feel good or make you feel better or has a promise that you'll enjoy the rest of your life? You got a brain that you were born with, and it develops and it grows. You must grow with it and keep it in line with what you want to do, so therefore it makes sense to you. So the more you use your brain, the more it grows. But you must use your brain. So this is why we say when you have a problem or a choice, you start analyzing. That is, you bounce it around your brain or you kick it around for a little while so you understand the pros and the cons, and then you make a righteous decision.
Thank you, Dennis. You know, I was thinking, I'm sure everyone's heard of Bob Marley. I once heard him say that, and I saw an interview with him, that he said, "My home is in my mind. No matter where I am, I have to live within my..." And this is a very important point. Hopefully everyone listening to the live presentation or eventually the archive presentation has a stable housing situation. But even more, just as important, and again, I don't want to diminish the housing issue because it is my personally owned man on the street's view is that housing is a human right, whether it be whatever country a person's in, but that a person has to feel at home within their own mind, within their own consciousness. And when there's a disturbance in our mind, there's a disturbance in an important aspect of our home, our temporary home, meaning our human body. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Well, your mind is your home because no matter what happens, no matter what happens, you have your mind. It's right between your ears, and it's very close, and you can use it anytime you want. But there's certain rules that we have to apply to the mind. First of all, can you love yourself? If you can't love yourself, then you can't love your fellow human beings. And why must you love your fellow human beings? Because we are all God's creatures. If he made us, we must honor that. So if you can love yourself, love your neighbor, you can certainly love God because you practice on other human beings. And that is a positive sign that you respect God's work. Work in the sense that he created us and that recreation keeps happening. It's a continuous source of positive thinking that we can recreate, just like all the vegetables and all the flora and fauna of the earth is recreating, so is your mind. You are part of the whole recreation process that God put in place. If you can't love him for that, then you better start reading a little bit more about how your mind works.
I mean, that was beautiful. Dennis, do you have anything to share with us before we start to get some more of the biblical or Hasidic teachings about meditation? From God to the Perplexed by the Nesher Gadol, the great eagle, Rambam.
Well, what happens is Rambam said, think. If you think, you'll do good. You'll come out positive. Why? Because your brain is a positive gland, a positive part of your body. It doesn't come out with all these bad things from the dark side. That's what you imagine. That's what you have fear for. That's what you are afraid of. But if you stick with the positive and the paths that have been depicted by different people, especially the Rambam, of how to control your emotions, how to control your thoughts, you will be a better person. and why not try it? What have you got to lose?
Thank you, Dennis. Okay, so let's go. We're going to basically be now, and I hope this will be our continuing series. Dennis, you know, we've done various types of series. But I do think that to bring back the human family experience to some sort of baseline of broader, deeper, more nurturing type of dialogue, we have to really spend a lot of time in this series, hopefully, to develop into part one until we get enough people really making a difference with their own changes, not just our own, ourselves as well. The idea that every person has been graced by the Almighty, the knowledge and sensitivity to perceive, meaning to perceive the profundity of any matter, and to understand it, and at whatever level he or she is capable to elucidate on the profundity that they themselves are individually perceiving. And then it should be each and every person, him or her, according to the understanding of his or her heart. Now, Rashi, the foremost elucidator upon the written Torah by his oral Torah explanations, many times was quoted in his explanations of the five books of Moses as Libi Amar Li. Literally it means my heart told me, but it's always translated to mean my mind told me. Meaning Rashi was so sensitive that he could understand the intellect of the heart and be able to elucidate that profundity that his heart was perceiving, which many of us are very, you know, sensitive to what our heart is feeling, whether it be we're in a crowded building or we hear the roar of a dog or we hear a sudden stoppage on the subway, our heart jumps, or you ever get too close to a mountainside and all of a sudden you shudder. So that's not just an emotional reaction. That's an intelligent perception. But at that point, we're not able to elucidate on it. So, but still yet, the writer of these teachings on meditation, according to the Torah and Hasidic tradition, the Rebbe of Dov Ber of Lubavitch, that the Almighty seeks out all hearts. And why would this Almighty seek out all hearts? Because the Almighty is found in the content of all hearts. And King David wrote about, with all my heart I seek you. Now, one of the things that I want to share with you is that we're taking a more cognitive, meditative perspective with this series, God willing, but not to diminish the importance of mindfulness, of paying attention to your breath, to for some people it means to go out into a field and be mindful of the grass and the bees and the dandelions and the little stream floating by them and the ducks flying over their head, and all of a sudden they hear a dog barking in the background. And instead of falling prey to their anxiety, which is a horrible human experience, we've all gone through it, and one of the things I wish we had time to cross-pollinate more ideas from other things that I've learned, but there is this idea that when your trust, and let's add your faith as well, is so strong in the Creator, that in itself is a form of mindfulness, blessed souls. However, because we travel out into society where we're overstimulated many times, and I'll admit I've been overstimulated by my immediate environment, and then I get overstimulated within my thought and emotional process. So we need tools. As I say in the field that I'm in, social services, we have to educate our clients and educate ourselves to remind ourselves how many tools we have in our human toolbox to make a situation better. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Yes, we are all born equal, but not equal lives. We don't imitate other people, but we do abide by what the rules were given to us by our parents when we were growing up. And those rules are basically religious-related rules. In other words, you weren't born to practice in the world willy-nilly. No, you were told there were certain rules you should follow. And the more you think about the rules, the better the choices on your part, because you're giving your mind a chance. That means we were building a conscience in everybody. And if you listen to your conscience, it's a lot better than listening to the news or the headlines in media of any type. So your conscience will not steer you wrong in the worst way you can possibly think of. Yes, you'll make mistakes. We are imperfect. We're going to make mistakes. But we try to keep the mistakes at a minimum. small mistakes that we learn from. So we must think about things before you act or before you react. You must remember, think about it thoroughly, and when you think you understand it, then you can move forward and make your decisions. But you must check it out with your conscience. And your mind is reliable. It doesn't change overnight. You have built it to what it should be. Now use it.
Amen. So thank you, Dennis, for those are very potent words. And now we'd like to get more into the within the context of, again, a biblical Hasidic viewpoint of what meditation is. Again, we're talking about the cognitive meditative approach. Again, for some people, they feel very, I myself am very attracted to it. For those who are not, it's just something to bring to your awareness once it's over. And if you feel empowered much and probably more so than, say, the cognitive meditative experience, more power to you, and just stick to your mindfulness and spreading the awareness of the benefits of mindfulness and meditating among, you know, the breaths that you're inhaling through your nose and your mouth. It's a wonderful form of calming down one's anxiety. But here we're talking about now where already a person has made a decision to gather in a certain body of knowledge, whatever it may be, complex, simple, somewhere in between simple and complex, but it's going to produce an outcome of movement, of excitement. Now, we're not talking about excited like a dog is excited when the owner takes out a dog bone or its favorite dog treat. We're talking about excitement in the classical Hebrew sense means to be a movement, that which causes movement. And when you start to get involved in getting a body of data, whether, again, a simple or complex, somewhere in between type of concept, your mind is going to become engaged. It's going to be moved to want to follow the process of the logic of that subject matter now that you're learning. What also can happen is that your heart will be moved, and we all know that we've discovered something that we were totally unaware of. Something like that happened to me the other last week or the week before. I just don't remember. I'll have to try to bring it out maybe later on today or a future time. But also that which gets moved and energized and running and firing on a higher caliber of cylinders, allegorically speaking, is your thought process. So first, a person is going to have the experience of interacting with some sort of knowledge. They become engaged in it with their mind. Emotionally, they feel more attracted to it. And they're thinking about it not only during the time of the acquisition or the reception of this knowledge, but how to go forth into, say, trying to present it in another style and not betraying the intent of the new knowledge that they've just interacted with. Dennis, any thoughts about these matters?
Yeah, the word knowledge is something that always attracts me. Why? Because we don't know everything. There's no one person that knows everything. And the one thing we know from history is that we are always learning. We never stop learning because we don't know everything. We always ask questions. We have inquisitive people everywhere. The worst thing you can do to another person when they start asking questions is to tell them to shut up. That means you want to stop the learning process because we ask questions. I don't care what age you are, we have questions for everything. If you think you have the answers, then you don't have to think about it. But since you don't know everything, you must think about it and you must use your mind because your collective knowledge means everything that you've learned while you've been living on this planet. And if you haven't learned enough, maybe you're not using your mind.
Sure. Very good. Thank you, Dennis. Now, going further, so just like there's a body to a car, there's a body to an airplane, there's our own physical body. Even in awareness, and therefore then once one gains an awareness of an idea, that there's the approach called meditation, or hisbononos in the Hebrew. And what is the body of this meditative process, this cognitive meditative process, is we have to ask ourselves first two questions. What is it in its essence? What is this process that we're calling meditation, cognitive meditation? And therefore, once we understand what is cognitive meditation, what choices should we make upon to meditate according to the subject matters that passes by us in our daily living experiences, or on special days, like, say, the day that you have off from work? What, aside from the day-to-day activities that we'll engage in, what if you want to go beyond the day-to-day activities and perceptions of your engagement with activities and want to see beyond the curtain, as they say, beyond the matrix, as they would say in the movie industry, beyond normal human consciousness, which is something which is advocated, I think, by the Eastern traditions. So the way the Mittler Rebbe describes this is that if we were to pull apart this cognitive, meditative, analytic experience, what is in essence is, it is the commitment to look very strong about a subject matter and to seek out the truth of the matter. Now, we as human beings will never see the entire truth, but there's levels of truth that can become accessible to us. Like, for instance, as a small child, the truth that I learned was 1 plus 1 equals 2. But as I got older, I could put a 1 over 2 as a fraction and a 2 over 1, and somehow I could, the denominator, I think it was, where you have 2 over 1, I could turn that into 2 and then double the 2 on top, so it becomes 5 parts over 2, 2.5. But when I was learning 1 plus 1 equals 2, I had no awareness that eventually I would be learning fractions when I was like 5th, 6th, or 7th grade. So it is a commitment. And we're all at the beginning levels, blessed souls, in terms of the meditative process, because we can meditate, become conscious, but what we're not conscious of, we're still not even at the level of beginner. So when we – actually, one of the – this Rebbe mentioned that we are at the beginner stage just to learn the process of how to meditate. And even if we get a knowledge, which is considered to be abundant, which not too many people have, but there are people that do have it, still at the next level where they don't have the abundant knowledge, they have to start again. They have to renew themselves. Dennis, this whole idea of a commitment to stay with something until they can find the truth that is relative to their existential level of consciousness. Your take on these matters.
Well, I use the word thinking in association with meditation. Now, as you keep thinking, as you keep meditating, you're learning. And your learning is creating a memory. Your memory is going to be used over and over and over. If you see that it works, it's positive, well, that's only a reinforcement of association. And everything we do is associated. Remember, we weren't built to be a singular entity on the planet. We were built to deal with other humans.
Mm-hmm.
No man is an island, and no person is all by themselves. You always have your memory, you always have your mind, and there are other people around. And there's no way of just obliterating all that. You accumulate memory. And based on your memory, you only enhance your level of knowledge. But those relationships stay with you. You learn between right and wrong. Well, that doesn't go away whether you're 10 years old or 80 years old. Right and wrong doesn't change. So therefore, your memory is working. It sticks to what works, and you've thought about it, you've meditated, and you believe that your mind has developed something. It has developed something positive because we are positive humans, and made in the image of Almighty, we will continue to think on a positive basis. So therefore, rely on your memory. Now, some people say, well, my memory isn't so good. Well, your consciousness will still work whether your memory does or doesn't.
True. Very nice, Dennis. Now, we mentioned what is this process of, and by the way, thinking is also an expression of meditating, even within the context of the Hebrew language. So you picked up on a very good point. It translates well into English and back into Hebrew as thinking being a process of meditating. So that's a very important point, Dennis. Thank you for bringing that out. I didn't mention that. So once we've sort of given this terse entrance level into the gateway of what is the body of the meditative experience, the question is now, what shall we meditate upon? Now, the thrust of this book, which hopefully we'll cover it in future presentations, the Blessing of the Most High, is to analyze cause and effect relationships chaining down throughout the creation. The allegory that's given is that you have a chain. So the lowest part of the higher chain intertwines itself with the highest point of the lower chain. And when you shake the chain, it's not just the highest part of the lower link shaking or causing vibrations to the lowest part of the higher link. It actually reverberates all the way to the top for wherever the chain link started. So what we want to become aware of, or we have the option of becoming aware of, it's we have to make the choice what we're going to meditate upon. It could be on the profundity of a pineapple tree, the interaction between an amoeba under the microscope and some sort of substance that we spray upon it, which I remember I did in my sophomore year in high school. It can be matters of godliness, which are mentioned in the Torah, or other, you know, people have other endeavors that they consider their faith. That's, you know, that's a cup of tea, fine. But we want to understand, or we have the option of understanding, is that any concept we're going to start to interact with in Blessed Souls is that it has three general dimensions, and these dimensions are not static terminologies, but they kind of they form like a triangle. And just like a wheel spins and the top becomes the bottom and the bottom becomes the middle becomes the side, whatever. So we have to engage fully in the cognitive meditative process, which is accessible to all human beings if they choose to, if there's the depth of what other subject matter we're going to learn, meaning the essence of it is, meaning if you just peel back the onion and bring it back to the, go into the epicenter of the onion, what would you find? The orech, the length, which is once we have a certain level of understanding, a competency in that understanding based on our meditative experience, how can we simplify it to other people, even to take a very complex concept and bring it down to the level of a small child? So we start to nurture them at their level to eventually want to grow in their comprehension process, in their understanding process. And the rochav is basically, if you're going to study a subject, you want to know, you want to have the breadth or the width, you want to have the details of the subject. I know that last summer, I'll give an example, Dennis, I went to Bear Mountain, and Bear Mountain in the summer, they have these car shows where they model cars. There was nothing from, I don't think there was anything younger than like 2010, maybe 2008, and they had a car from 1931. So one of the things I found neat was looking at the engine of a car from 1931 and then looking at an engine of a car in 2007. It's like, one looks like it came from the caveman era, 1931 engine. It looked like just a couple of pieces of metal with some wires, you know, hooked to it this way, or rubber hoses. And the 2007-2008 car looked like something that I could pull out of the back of my laptop with all the computer nuances. But at the same time, too, I should be aware of the principles of motion that apply to a 1931 car are the same as the principles of motion apply to a car from 2007-2008. So here we are, sort of like a very general presentation of an allegory of how we develop a knowledge of, say, the subject matter of cars, car technology. So, Dennis, your take on these matters.
Well, I'd like to bring up the subject of night and day, and that is during the day, we control our minds. You are in charge of your mind. You think about what you want to. You don't think about something that you don't know about, unless you're imagining things. But if you think about it and meditate, you will be sane and you have a conscience, because you're not going to be thinking about bad things. Your conscience would remind you. However, at night, we don't control our minds. Our minds are free spirits to a certain extent, but it uses associations and other things that have been put in our memory from the daytime. So even though you don't want to think about it, your mind can handle it at night. Now, some people say it gives them nightmares. They don't get enough sleep. I just didn't get rest. But that's you. How you trained your mind to think, and those thoughts that you put in your mind. So your sleep time thoughts are a reflection of what you did during the day or things that occurred. Mm-hmm. You cannot invent things that don't exist. If you do, you start daydreaming, and that requires meditation or daytime thoughts to handle. So must be careful that what we dream at night is not necessarily what we control during the day. That doesn't mean we don't want to control it. It's just that you're relaxed and you let your mind go and your conscience is not that active as it is during the day. So there's two sides of the brain, one where you have it under control and one where you don't have it under control.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to get it under control, because it still reflects what you did during the day is what you will think about in your mind or memory at night.
True. I think there are, I don't know if they're yogis or it's some Eastern practitioners of meditation, where I've seen a video where they were wrapped in very cold towels that were like basically in like freezing water temperature. And they, through their meditative process, were able to prevent themselves from feeling cold, which is reflected by the fact that it didn't reduce their temperature, their body temperature. And I think maybe they'd even did bread kind. So, you know, we react involuntarily, generally speaking, to like weather conditions. But we see that there's clinical evidence to show with a certain type of meditation, we can actually fight back and be more in control of our internal thermostat, however you want to, you know, depict that in biological terms. I don't know what the term is, if such a term exists.
Well,
so we
before you go to bed, you watch a couple of scary movies, really scary, gory movies. What do you think you're going to dream about when you go to sleep?
Right.
Are human. Yeah. We are influenced by associations. You must be careful with those associations, because if you don't think about it, you can jump into association that you really don't want. So we have to worry about what happens at our weakest moment. In other words, when you're feeling really strong, you love God, and you're sure you know everything that's right and wrong, you have confidence in yourself. But what happens when you go to sleep? Do you have the same confidence that you're only going to think about those positive things that you like during the day and stay away from those other things?
True. I find it a very tough scenario to portray that a person who watches Rambo 1, 2, and 3 will dream about some hippie with long hair eating, you know, a bean sprout saying, "Peace, man." Probably not going to dream about the peacemaker and watching three Rambo videos. Dennis, I want to close out today's presentation with a very quick presentation. Let's say a person wants to associate meditation, again, the cognitive form, with a more superficial, cursory style of gaining or acquiring new knowledge. So what happens if a person does not sink their eye, so to speak, allegorically speaking, or the eye of their mind, or the mind of their eye, and does not meditate, do some sort of cognitive processing of the matter and its qualitative factors and what it is made up of, and all its particulars and particularities, or rather just passes over the subject matter and saying, "Oh, I've meditated on something in a general way." Well, in the span of time, eventually they'll forget what they were supposed to have a profound experience of meditating, but they forgot it because their approach was too superficial. Also, let's say they did get some sort of excitement, which they could recall, but because they didn't, you know, process the particularities that excited them at the time that they were learning it, becoming aware of them. So they're not really able to explain to someone else, "Wow, you know, I did this, I had this cognitive meditative experience," but they could only describe it in a general way. So they'll leave the person mostly getting the impression that, ho-hum, that's what floats his boat is great, but it's not something that I want to get involved in. And perhaps the most deleterious effect of perceiving that a profound meditative cognitive experience is based on the first reasoning you get from the first cursory reading of it, eventually a person will come to a realization which could undermine that whole experience and then downplay it or diminish the enthusiasm of others who want to learn how to meditate is, "I don't understand what the purpose of learning these things are. Why should I be aware of how my body works? Why should we be aware of these Torah teachings, these teachings of prophecy, which have a lot to do as the outcome of the meditative process of these prophets, but people have to learn more about that. So Dennis, what could we do to try to encourage people, not just to think, everyone understands they have to think, but to not think of thinking as a humdrum, automatic process, just like if I pedal my wheels, the spokes and my tires are going to follow suit.
Well,
it's more than just that. Thinking is not static. It's an active, blessed experience for the mind.
Yes. What happens is all humans have a dilemma, and the dilemma is resolved and unresolved issues. In other words, when you resolve something, you put it in its place, you understand it, and you don't really have too many more questions about it. But the problem is the unresolved issues. You didn't get an answer, you're not satisfied with, it's still bothering you. It's a lingering effect. Now, the other thing is, if you want to stay away from worrying about unresolved issues, is you must pick some subjects that you can do deep meditation, deep thinking about, and get lost in. Why? Because you feel confident in it, but you're seeking to find an answer. And you will not have a peaceful mind unless you come out with an answer. Unresolved issues lead to so many different problems. It's a huge laundry list, and you don't want to get involved. So what you try to do is steer your mind into something that's peaceful, satisfying, and doesn't cause more problems. Now, during the day, you can pick out some of these subjects. And if you think about those subjects, love of God, love of a religion, love of other people, you'll feel a little bit better when you go to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Doug. I just want to mention that we're going to be now closing our program. Before we do, I want to give a little promo for my son, Yosef Yitzchak, whose bar mitzvah you were at, Dennis, if I recall, you and your wife of valor. It was, it's 8 years ago since we all got together. Remember the Jewish Children's Museum in Crown Heights. And my son is enlisted with a bunch of other young men, God willing, with God, the Almighty's blessings, to ride across America from San Jose, California, to New York City. The process is over 6 weeks. And it's called the Friendship Circle Marathon Bike Ride. And it's to raise awareness about the work that this Chabad organization, the Lubavitch organization, does to provide respite for parents who have children with what we call disabilities, or another perspective that they're uniquely capable. So I was looking for a theme song for my son, and I found the song, and I want to use this as the segue ending music to our shows, hopefully going forward, For a Dream, because we all have a dream, blessed souls. We all have a dream, and that is within our higher sense of our interacting with our divine image. We want a world of a havachad, one love, goralachad, one destiny, kolano, was bedarkenam dakshim, in a peaceful, pleasant way. And I want to say, first I want to thank you, Dennis. I want to say something, one more thing before we end today's presentation. I want to thank you. It's been wonderful to reunite with you. Dennis, what else do you have to say that our listeners can take away as like the dessert to today's humble food for thought session?
You're better off being a thinking person than a non-thinking person.
Okay, I think you're right. ladies and gentlemen, human beings of all ages, here's a song for a dream. Go find your team. Go help others, sisters and brothers from different mothers, and you'll see it's a much better place. Take care. This is For a Dream by RJ2. Take care, everyone.
Finish line, knowing it begins at the starting line. Breathe in, breathe in out, building lives on this given route. Take a step, finish a mile, be an equal man, energy like a child. Rhythm kicks in and out in stride. Well, here I come with all my pride. Here I come with all my pride. I run for a his dream, to create history, to create